You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. All right, Rachel, you had a question before we started recording.
Yeah.
What is it?
Chicken or shrimp? No.
If we know the answer is beef, Rachel.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say chicken beef or shrimp, so joke's on you.
Jokes.
Would you rather chili or beef?
Oh.
Sorry, go ahead. Just kidding.
Beefless chili or beef?
I was going to say chili tends to have beef, so I would go chili.
That's a big debate, actually. Some people don't want
chili carne or non carne. Mm. Yeah. No, I think it's beef because it's chili con carne, which is with meat.
So you can have chili without meat, but you can't have... without meat, but you can't have chili without beans. Is that what it is?
I think chili without beans is like stew.
Yeah. It's just pasta sauce at that point.
It's just pasta sauce.
Just tomato.
I think that's accurate.
With corn.
With corn? Yeah. That'd be the only distinction.
I feel like that's a Ted Lasso joke. Like, oh, that's just chili without beans. It's just,
you know what I heard the other day? Someone, I was listening to a podcast and they were doing this like elaborate intro. And the first thing the guest said in response to that intro was, man, that's a whole lot of gravy for a little turkey. And I can't stop thinking about that phrase. It's like, it's so good.
Okay, but no, for real, Rachel, you had an actual question.
Speaking of gravy.
If you
had to choose between a personal chef or a personal driver, I guess just a driver, a chef or a driver, what would you choose?
Imagine having a chef that's like, welcome, Mr. Sneed. Mm-hmm. On the menu tonight, we're thinking of having some beanless chili.
Here's where I'm torn on this one.
Oh, you like cooking.
I like cooking.
This is like if you had your own personal car washer, huh?
Exactly.
Like
it. Exactly. I like to cook, so I enjoy the process, but I can guarantee you I would eat healthier if I had a professional chef. Because here's my thing with food, and this is often in our house too. I actually don't like picking the meal. Like if Lindsay just tells me, hey, cook this, I love to do that. I'm like, yeah, I'll cook that. Like that sounds great. So I think if I had a personal chef that just picked the meals, like I'll eat almost anything you just put in front of me, which is why I'm not, you know, why I can tighten up my healthy eating. But if I had a personal chef, I feel like I'd just tell them, hey, just make me eat clean, and they just put good stuff in front of me. So that's where I'm torn, because I don't see the benefit of the driver though.
Oh man,
I like my drive time.
Well, as Rachel, I mean, you could still have drive time though. Imagine sitting in the back seat and you're just like looking out the window like a
dog.
I don't
like that.
That's just,
I like doing dogs. Something. Yeah, while I drive. Like I really? Like I'm kind of, when we do family road trips, if we're driving 18 hours to Montana, I'm driving 17 and a half of them. And for some reason there's 30 minutes I don't, cuz I'm tired. But I'm taking it all. Like I drive, like I don't know. I don't mind driving.
I'm considering driver, and here's why. One time I was so busy. This is so long ago. I'm so much better now. I would never do this. But before I was a Christian,
okay.
I had a meeting in Livermore. Someone was getting married or something, and I was going to meet the couple.
Yeah.
And it was in Livermore. Very inconvenient, but I had said yes to it. And I had so much stuff, like stuff that I needed to get done that day. And so I figured the best way that I could do it was just, let me just Uber.
To Livermore.
It was like $100 each way.
Wow.
And, but you know what? I worked in the back seat, put on my headphones, like said hi to the driver, said, like, I'm not going to be talking to you.
I'm envisioning the pickup scene here. So you're standing outside your house next to your car.
I think I was at work. I think I was here.
Okay. So you left your car at work.
Yeah.
To get picked up in Uber to go to Livermore.
So I could continue to work. Yeah.
How responsible.
See, I don't know. That feels a little more workaholic.
Well, could you imagine having your laptop open while driving?
I would never do that. I would never have my laptop open while I was driving. I would also never put my phone up on the dash to watch a show while I was driving. I wouldn't do that.
Or to watch a show?
Just hypothetically.
Oh, man. I've done it before where like I'm listening to like a Warriors game. And I'll plug it into, you know, Hulu's on my phone or whatever. I'm not necessarily watching, but it's there so I can hear it.
I watched you while driving today, Kevin. Listen to your sermon. If I got pulled over, I'd be like, it's a sermon.
It's a sermon. What are you going to do? Yeah, what are you going to do?
God is protecting this car. You could have a little bumper sticker that says, I watch sermons while I drive.
If you see Rachel, sermon, what about,
you didn't answer though. Driver or chef?
I think chef.
Yeah. It's the right choice. It's the right choice.
Technically, living at home, my mom has taken that role happily. So
I think Katie would be really mad at me if she knew I chose driver. Because she does the bulk of the cooking.
Oh.
So
she'd be mad at you if you chose chef.
If I chose driver, she would be mad.
Oh, because she doesn't like the cook.
She does not want to.
It is pure function. Okay, I gotcha. Yeah, she does not enjoy the process. Yeah, that's true. When you cook like every day, it gets old.
But that says so much about you, Kevin, that you're choosing the process of making food over efficiency. Like, you're like, I don't know if I'd want a cook. Even though it would be way more efficient, you'd be healthier.
Well, I think my choice still is the cook, though.
Oh,
I don't think I'd want a driver because I don't see the benefit of a driver. I don't think I would do work in the car. I don't think I'd.
What would you do?
Well, I'd be driving. That's why I'm not picking a driver. I'd be cruising down 280 or whatever. Oh. Yeah, I don't know. Even when Lindsay drives on road trips, like, I don't know what to do. I just sit there and it's not like bad. I don't mind. Like, there's something cathartic about just cruising down I-5, you know, and just it helps me look out the window. I feel restless if I were in passenger seat trying to look out the window.
Could this be Kevin Snead admitting that boredom is hard?
I've never said it wasn't hard. I said it's a net good.
Oh,
I think boredom. Brandon and I have this ongoing debate about if boredom is a good thing. And I think it is. I think boredom is a good, I think it's a virtue.
Straight from almost Dr. Kevin Snead, your marriage should be boring. Your marriage should be mostly boring. Take that to a marriage conference. Bring that to sell that book.
Yeah.
What's the conference they always have? A weekend to remember. Bring that and be like, you know what?
A weekend to forget. It'll be my counter conference.
It was the most boring weekend of my life. Thank you, Lord, for this boring marriage.
But then every other weekend's better.
But here's the thing. You can't just live on the mountaintops. Didn't we just talk about that? The valleys are kind of boring. And the majority of life is in the valleys. So we should probably get comfortable with boredom.
I feel bad for you that your life is so boring. I want to spice it up for you.
You always spice it up, Brandon.
That's my whole goal. I'm hoping to put that on my job description.
Life spicer.
You bring the meat to the chili.
You could be the spice boy. I was trying to think of a joke with spice girls.
Spice boy.
Spice boy? It's like Shark Boy and Lava Girl. Like,
I couldn't think of anything for Spice Girls.
That
for
is
you.
The title of this episode.
Is that your first email?
Spice Boy.
Spice Boy 42.
Spice Boy 83.
At hotmail.com.
Earthlink.
Earthlink. Oh, no. I almost did it again.
Do you remember Juno email?
Oh yeah, Juno.
This is what we
Rachel
had.
Does not remember
like
Juno.
This would have been like in the like mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
Juno was like a free email client. You plug in your dial-up modem.
Yeah.
56K. And then it goes.
Which
like
dial-ups made that made a reference in my sermon too. That's twice in a week. Yeah. Dial-up connection has made an appearance.
And then it does like a little like progress bar and it takes so long and then all of a sudden you're like, I have an email. That's how it used to go.
Yeah.
Do know.
It's true. I remember Instant Messenger. I'm sure you remember that. AIM.
AIM. Yeah.
Yeah. And then MSM Messenger or MSN.
Oh.
Yeah. I remember that. That's how I asked my first girlfriend out. Was
on MSN Messenger?
MSN Messenger. Wow. Beth Sturgis.
What'd she say?
Well, she said yes, and then 3 days later, she dumped me, so it didn't stick too long.
Oh, no.
MSN Messenger. I don't think I ever had MSN. I had Yahoo Messenger.
Yahoo. Mm. Yeah.
Yahoo.
AIM was the big one. It was big time back then.
Yeah.
Riveting. here we are. This is the part. This is the part in the podcast where we make a trendy or a good shift.
Well, it doesn't really matter because I always
was a hard shift.
I always chop this part anyway.
That's true. Like, maybe this time you'll leave it. They'll see how the sausage is made. You'll see it.
Have you seen how sausage is made? By the way,
no, because I'm gonna have a personal chef. I won't have to see it. Is it not worth eating?
Well, no, it's worth eating, but it's just like. Like, I remember one time
it's worth eating. Yeah, it's still good.
I went to an Italian family's house one time when they were making sausage to see how the sausage was made. And, like, you're part of it. You don't just get to watch. So, like, they put, like, pounds and pounds of meat on this table. And, like, they put all the spices, the special...
Spice Boy.
Family recipe, which is where I got my name, Spice Boy. And then all of you, you know, wash your hands, and then you, like, just dig in, and you hand, like, mix the meat and the spices. You're doing it for, like, you know, 30 minutes. Just sausage. And then you put it in these little nasty little casings, and it looks so gross. That's where it looks the grossest. When you're like
squeezing it
into the casing,
tubing it into the casing. Yeah,
that's where it's gross. But then you fry it up, and you're like, "I made that."
You took more pride in because you made the sausage.
It tasted better. I don't even like sausage, but that sausage I liked.
A little Italian Spice Boy sausage,
handmade.
Handmade Spice Boy sausage.
For hours.
Anyway, speaking of sausage, when you talked about experience over authority, so you began by starting Kevin off with, there's sort of been like a generational shift recently where, experience is valued when it comes to truth over authority, where we kind of did that differently earlier. We thought authority and knowledge would have kind of a higher,
weight.
In our culture. Explain that a little bit more.
Yeah. So I think, you know, previous generations were, I don't know if like more rationally inclined, like if that's the right way to say it, but were more convinced through argument than they were in, experience or participation, if you will. So, you know, I think like a question would be, you know, who has... I heard this example last week as I was doing some research around the sermon. Was like, you know, in today's day and age, who would you say has more authority to speak on something like suffering, right? Is it, you know, and the example I heard this week was, is it the pastor who's sitting in a bougie coffee shop, like reflecting on verses around suffering? Is it the academic who has formally studied suffering, you know, through different eras of history? Or is it the person who's actually like endured suffering? Right? Like, that's an interesting question to think through, like who holds the authority on that conversation? Most of us, I think in kind of the modern world now would say, well, probably the one who's actually endured suffering. And I think in generations past, it isn't that they would discredit that experience, but rather I think they would hold it closely to the one who could also just, it would be devoid of like sitting in a classroom and studying something like suffering. Like those two things would both be valid. Like I'm finding, at least what I think, is younger generations are less and less inclined to give ear to the kind of truth claims that are, you know, disconnected from experience. Like we're starting to question those more. Some of that in healthy ways, probably other ways where it's, you know, we can discredit someone's claims to truth, you know, regardless of their experience. And so in the modern world, we've pit truth and experience against each other. And we've kind of said that one or the other wins out. And it tends to fall on generational lines. It's obviously speaking in like super broad generalizations, but that tends to be the way that we've differentiated those is truth over experience or experience over truth. But I think, you know, what I was trying to get at through there is saying both of those are insufficient, particularly when we talk about like following the way of Jesus and the need to hold both kind of truth and experience like together in unison. So I don't know if you guys, if that would be your experience, like if you guys think the same way, but that, and there I am leaning on your experience, but I would think that that tends to be the way we engage with, you know, cultural dialogue or whatnot.
As I'm just thinking about it, having done no research at all about it, I'm thinking, I wonder if it's a, if it is a generational thing or if it's just, these are the times, because now in the information age, there's almost no new information, you know, like when I like tell Olivia something, like she's heard it, you know, yeah. So, like we have access to anything we want to know for the first time really ever. Like,
yeah.
And I really remember this. I don't know if I've told you this before. I remember when YouTube kind of first started coming out.
Yeah.
And I remember it blowing my mind that for the first time I could type almost anything into this search server.
Yeah.
And it would find almost anything I wanted to look at. And the first thing for some reason that came to my brain was in camp when I remember it like stuck in my brain. This counselor who I just idolized at this Christian camp I grew up at, and he would catch flies out of the air like Mr. Miyagi, not with the chopsticks, but just with his hand. He would just catch a fly.
You YouTubed how to do that?
No, hold on. Okay. And then he would take a girl's hair. He would pluck a hair out of the girl's head.
I've seen this.
He would tie the hair around the fly's body. Or a leg or something. And then it would just fly around like in circles.
Oh my God.
And I remember like it blew my mind so much when I saw it. And I was like, man, I spent time thinking.
What a time to be alive.
I wish I could see that again.
And
I remember when it blew my mind, I could see this. And I typed it in and sure enough, there was, you know,
there it is.
A bunch of people.
There it is.
But we forget, you know, that was only, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. But we forget that like, it didn't used to be like this.
Yeah.
We didn't used to have everything that we ever wanted to know and conflicting truths.
Yeah.
Which is the whole thing with the AI thing, right?
Yeah, like
at the end of the day, when you ask it, someone is telling it which truth to believe in.
Yeah.
And so the idea
or
that
maybe a better way to say it would be conflicting truth claims.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, to get a bit pedantic. But
Thank you for getting pedantic. I appreciate that.
I knew you wanted me to. You're welcome, Spice Boy. But there is, and I think that's one of the enormous shifts is both access to information, but at the same time, like, although we all have access to it, the problem becomes it dilutes the ability to like you still have to process information, right?
It's like overload, right?
Yeah, it's not just overload, but it's also all information is not equal. And that I think in a world where truth isn't standing as something that is ultimate because of information to everything, I think that's one of the gifts the church has to offer. Again, is this assertion that says, you know, you may disagree, and that's a different conversation, but we are going to claim that there is in fact an ultimate truth. Whether or not, you know, how my experience plays out in understanding that and interpreting it is certainly worthy of all sorts of dialogue, and why like a diverse community is important to engage ultimate truth because we see it from different angles, but you can't like it diminishes expertise. This is why just because you have access to it doesn't mean you're an expertise in things.
Yeah.
And we've seen that play out, I mean, 1,000 times over, right, in our society. And so that's where I think the experience comes in too. But on the flip side, just because you've experienced something doesn't inherently make you an expert on it, right? And so that's where I think both of these things become insufficient as far as like ways to understand truth and how to live and align our lives towards that. And so I think the way I put it on Sunday is, you know, truth and experience are two sides of the same coin. And this is really the work of, any engagement with Jesus we have to wrestle with, and any statement or claim of theology is one in which you have to balance both truth claims with experience, and both of those instruct you. Right. And that's why, again, I think the educational model of a disciple and a rabbi, of an apprentice and an expert, if you will, it makes a whole lot of sense when you think about like quite literally walking behind Jesus. You're hearing his teaching and then you're watching it played out in real life, and you're learning both the way as well as the truth. And those two things, you know, and then that's that verse in John 14 I talked through was the way of Jesus plus the truth of Jesus is the life of Jesus. And again, I ripped that right from Eugene Peterson, but that's what I think we have to revive. And we so often approach, and this one feels a little more, well, I don't know if it's generational or not, but we can tend to emphasize in different areas of the church one over the other. You know, and so when we emphasize just truth over lived practice, you get hypocrisy, right? When we're not willing to have our life align with the truths we're claiming. But on the flip side of that, again, if it's just the way we live, thinking we can just live any way we want and make statements and say, yeah, this is true because I live this way, you get relativism. That doesn't help us either.
What can you give us a little bit more? I like the church example. Like, give us something, some
how meat on the bones.
How have we seen this play out before?
Yeah. I briefly mentioned it yesterday, but I think when we elevate truth over lived experience and don't hold those together, or lived practice would be a better way to say that, I think it gives way to, like, the two examples I used from, like, the world of theology is a guy named John Howard Yoder. Brilliant thinker, put a ton of good in the world, but it comes out post his death that he had been abusing women and had been abusing his students. Yeah. Where you think of the Catholic Jean Vanier, who founded these communities, the LaArche communities around the world that were, they're essentially spaces in which handicapped and disabled people were able to engage on retreat and whatnot. Comes out later, he was abusing staff, not the disabled, but you know, still heinous nonetheless.
So the idea with those two examples is that they are saying one thing about what they believe
and living the other
and living a different way.
Yeah, yeah, and it creates.
Don't we all do that to a certain extent? Isn't that kind of like? Aren't we all kind of?
Yeah,
I know. I hope not to that level, but I mean,
yeah.
Isn't there a level of hypocrisy with like every single human?
No, I think there is. There's certainly, I think for all of us, a gap between what we profess and what we actually believe. I mean, that's that old adage, right? If I really wanted to know what you believed, I'd look at your calendar and how you spend your money. Like, that's going to dictate more what you believe than what you tell me you believe. But I think the difference that we're just seeing, I think, on a national scale, both in the church and outside the church, with all of these high-profile leaders just failing one after the other, is when we elevate what people say and truth higher than anything else without any concern for their lived lived practice of that, it creates this widening gap where character no longer matters. And that is like deeply problematic, which is why, again, like when we think of the early Christians, you know, they weren't known for their doctrinal statements, although those were important and did eventually play a role. Like, it wasn't that they were flippant, but what they were really known as distinctive was their way of living. Mm-hmm. And people watched the way they lived and said, man, that's radically different. And so they found a way to hold both those things in tension, or not even in tension, but just in unison of a different sort of understanding of God and Jesus, as well as then a lived expression in line with those beliefs that is different. And that, I think, is what the world's so hungry for. Is for a church, for a group of followers of Jesus who both profess Jesus as Lord and then find their lives being shaped by that claim. And everyone would say that. Like, no one's going to go around saying, I profess Jesus as Lord, but I don't care how I live, right? and so it forces us where we have to dig beyond just, like, I don't even know if beyond the teachings of Jesus is what I want to say, but we look at both the teachings of Jesus and the life of Jesus and recognize that he was just the most integrated person you've ever met, right? Like, his life was the same in his spoken teaching and in his living. And in some ways, that's what we're hoping to move beyond. But I'm getting a little preachy. But I think this is where it breaks down in our means of discipleship. Is often our discipleship kind of programs or processes are rooted really in just make sure you make the right truth claims and say the right things.
Yeah.
Now, those are important. We do want to do those. Again,
and this
it's
is
not
your orthodoxy.
Bad. Exactly. Yeah. As we make sure orthodoxy is perfectly aligned, I believe the right things, and then hopefully we live that way. And I think I think the moment is calling for us to revive that orthopraxy, that right living, and say both those things have to be in unison, which necessitates that our discipleship will have to be more than just processing information. Mm. It has to get the information, the way of Jesus, into our muscle memory, like into our bodies in a way where we then live loving our neighbor. We don't just talk about it. But like for me, the thing I've been learning, particularly on that example, is I can preach about loving my neighbor, but until I go talk to my neighbor, Patrick, do I actually love him? Till I show up and actually exist in his life, do I really love him? And as I've been like convicted personally of that, and I've been much better as I feel like God's been calling me to just go get to know Patrick more. I've literally been walking over there. I've been hanging. I've had coffee. I've sat in his living room. We've, you know, read the Bible because he asked to study the Bible with me, and we've drank coffee together and we've talked. And but until it gets to that place, I don't know if I actually believe love your neighbor.
Yeah.
And so it has to, our discipleship necessitates both of those things.
Like when our ideologies are revealed to be merely aspirational. I remember thinking the other day, you know, I've been trying to be really intentional with my little 8-year-old Charlie. And she will take as much as you give her. She's in that phase where she's very like demanding of your time, and having a teenager that suddenly doesn't want any of your time, like I'm more
drops off,
acutely aware, like enjoy this time. So, you know, the value in my head is that I want to spend more quality time with Charlie, and I want to do it. And then I get home in the context of a day, and I'm tired, and I've been talking to people all day, and I just want to come home and like shut my brain off.
Yeah.
I want to watch the golf tournament or something. Yeah. And then she comes in. So this, you know, last week she comes in and she had built, you could tell she was bored because she built, she found like a cardboard box and it fit her stuff, one of her stuffed animals perfectly. And so she had this whole, like complicated box that she had written all these different messages on. And she's like, I really want to show you this. And I was like, okay.
You're like, but Scheffler's on hole 7 and he's down 2.
And I'm like sitting there and like I started drifting. My attention started drifting, you know, back to the TV, and she's explaining to me. And she knows, like she looks up at me and she's gracious with me. But, and I was kind of confronted with, do I really?
Yeah.
Do I just say that I want to have?
Yeah.
Do I want to be able to say that I want to be close to Charlie, or do I want to actually be close to Charlie?
Yeah.
And I feel like there's an element in our faith, and that's why I get really excited about something like what we're talking about in these next few weeks with Sabbath, because I feel like in some ways, you know, you could go a direction with this and say this feels really legalistic and you're trying to, you know, make me practice, you know, old school, you know, whatever. Old Testament law. That's you know, Jesus freed us from all of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which we're not. It's not a legalistic thing, or you could let it confront you, and say, what do you really value? Okay, let's talk about why you can't even imagine, which there's so many people that can't even imagine making room in their life for a Sabbath.
Yeah.
Let's just like open that up and let that confront you on what you really want, the way that little box confronted me on what I really want with Charlie. And I ended up turning the TV off and saying, let's show me, and engaging and paying attention to all the little things she did. And I was like, this is really creative. I love this little girl, and how when she gets bored, she does some crazy, weird little project like this, you know?
Yeah. Because here's like the tension you're feeling in that moment, right? Where Charlie comes up to you with the box is, you know, the right move. Like, you know, both to say, I want to spend time with Charlie. You could probably even dig around, research, and study that time with your child pays off dividends down the road. Like, you could know all of it. Like, you could set up a small group that talks about reading something on parenting, and you study it together, and you realize this is better if I spend time with my daughter. But until you show up,
pay attention to thebox.com.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah. But until you like show up with your body and literally lift the remote, turn off the golf or whatever was on, and show up, you don't actually experience that. And the formative piece in that moment is not the studying shapes a vision for what could be, but it doesn't actually move you to be transformed until your intention shifts from wanting to sit on the couch to actually wanting to show up. And then all of a sudden in that you have the very, it's the means are really easy to attain there. It's like, I have to just be present with Charlie at some point. And so your thinking shapes your vision for what could be. Your intention is the moment where you like make a decision and say, I'm actually going to say yes when she brings this to me. And then the means to actually connect and be transformed as a dad, right, is when you spend that time together. Mm-hmm. And I think we get so caught, like, you can't think your way into Christ-likeness. Mm. There's no chance that that works. Now, I can give you a vision for what Christ-likeness is, but until you make that decision, that intention to say, I want to be a Christ follower, and then you need that third aspect of the means where you then say, okay, now how do I do this? And that's where these practices that we've learned, you know, from 2,000 years of church history help in that process. They're not a silver bullet, but something like Sabbath is going to force us and confront us with the other things we're not ready to give up. That's why I love the way you phrase that. It's like, just let it do something to you and ask the question, like, why is that resistant? And that interaction alone is formative, because you're showing up, you're forcing yourself to look at your calendar and then say, okay, what does this actually show about me and how? And not in a shame base, you don't love God unless you Sabbath. Like, that's not, like, we have to get beyond that. It's more of allowing a practice like this to just expose some of our heart and see if God meets us in there. But it isn't just something you do intellectually. It's something you do physically. And we have to get there.
So what if you... This is where my brain went. I'm just going to follow this.
Yeah.
What if you are in an iron lung? You can't move.
Yeah.
But you're fully conscious, but you can't actually move at all. Then what are you supposed to practice? How are you supposed to put your faith in action?
Yeah. It's a great question. I would think you got a whole lot of time for silence and solitude.
Yeah.
You can start there.
Renew your mind.
Yeah. But here's why, like,
if you had a chef, you could have people over for dinner.
You could.
But here's what's, I think, I'm going to get a little nerdy here. In a post-enlightenment kind of world in which Rene Descartes, who said, I think, therefore I am, has just, like, we've just bought that idea hook, line, and sinker, where we just walk around thinking we're brains on sticks. Mm. Most of us can't imagine that God would use our bodies to shape us.
Yeah.
Which is why something like fasting, which we'll talk about in the fall, is so foreign to us, because it's leveraging your body to then help and aid in the transformation of our spirit. Which we, because it gets back to this divorce we have between the physical and the spiritual. We think those are two different things. But again, Christian theology would say, no, you're both of those things fused together. And so we have such a hard time in the kind of late modern West of thinking that our bodies are actually part of our spirit and that they aid in that discipleship. But what did Paul say in Romans 12? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice.
Yeah.
Right, he's saying, bring the whole of who you are, your spirit, which even in there he says, you know, do not be conformed to the patterns of this world, be transformed by the renewing of your minds. So offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. He's tying together both the immaterial and the material together, and saying we bring all of that before God because all of it is needed to be transformed. And so something like Sabbath, again, we bring ourselves to it where we say, okay, I'm going to set aside certain aspects of my life to dedicate a whole day to the Lord. And so that it's forcing us to rearrange again the way we use our bodies, you know, to encounter that.
What do you think about that, Rach?
Well, I was thinking through truth and experience, and I think if we only focus on truth, then it's easy to stay detached. Yeah. From the experience, or like to say one thing, but does it truly have meaning and significance for the way you order your life? Which is why I think we tend to lean towards people who are embodying that truth or who have lived it out or have experienced it, because there's a sense of, okay, it's not just this detached idea, but it's something that I've seen play out sometimes for good, sometimes in challenging ways. But when we're experiencing it, it can't just be something we're detached from. We're forced to confront it in some way.
Yeah.
It's like just the difference between signing up for a gym and going working out at a gym.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You can know every bit about how to work out without ever actually doing it.
And one says you want to do it. One says you're putting your resources and money behind doing it.
Yeah.
Which is a necessary part of the process.
Yeah.
And that's where the truth, the cerebral part of things is important. Again, that's it, like you will not, if you start to work out and you don't have a vision of what's possible, I don't think you're ever going to make it long term.
Oh, yeah.
Like there is a vision in your head in which you say, I could become the kind of person who could run a marathon. And unless that is actually in your head, you'll never show up to do your training exercises. And this, by the way, I think is, again, partly why we need community and partly why I'm concerned that in the evangelical world, we so often get obsessed with celebrities. Mm. And think what you will about like the Catholic role of saints. And there's all sorts of theological things I think we could struggle with. But the fact is that the saints offer a vision of what's possible in the life of a disciple of Jesus.
Oh.
And there's something important about having those kinds of people, whether they're actual saints or whether it's your grandma who's faithfully followed Jesus for 80 years. Like that's a beautiful example of what's possible. Like we need people further down the road who we hold up and say, it's Paul saying, follow me as I follow Christ. Right. I think he didn't, I used to think that was such an audacious claim, and I think it still somewhat is, but it's also him saying like, you need exemplars of this.
Yeah.
And for his role as a leader in that community was to say, follow me as I follow Christ, and I'll do the best I can humbly to do that. Now, all of our human examples, the saints, whoever, they all fall short, of course, which is why, again, there's critiques of kind of that idea in the Catholic stream, but let's not lose the forest for the trees in the sense of, we need a vision for that, and we have to move beyond a sort of celebrity-obsessed culture that thinks just because they have a platform that they're more mature. I just don't think that's always the case.
So I want to, and you're going to be talking about a lot of this in the next few weeks, so we don't want to go too into it, but I thought we could get a tiny bit practical. I mean, you said you've been practicing Sabbath, and I don't know that we've had a podcast where you talk a little bit about your rhythm. Have you talked about your rhythm?
I don't know. Publicly? I've talked about in a couple sermons. I've kind of loosely done it, but I don't think I've done it on the podcast.
So you've practiced for
like, I think it's like 7 years.
And,
I was trying
and
to
love how
place
you
it.
Said it's not perfect. Mm. You know, there's,
yeah, it's never
there's
been
weeks
perfect.
That we break it. You know, that whole thing.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
I feel
yeah.
like that kind of made us all breathe a little bit easier.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
But you particularly start off with, you have kind of you develop a routine a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Explain a little bit of that.
Yeah, so we used to do ours on just Saturdays. We'd wake up Saturday morning, that'd be the start of our Sabbath. And that was good. What I found though is Friday night would just like become this crazy, chaotic, jam everything in kind of moment. And we'd actually shortcut my Sabbath because then by Sunday or Saturday evening, which still is the case, I'll usually pull my computer out, read through my sermon one time or whatever's going on there. And so we actually made an adjustment, which we do often to the Sabbath because it's, again, not a hard and fast thing, but something that's malleable and we're constantly changing. And so we start now our Sabbath on Friday nights. And so Friday night at sundown, we begin usually, again, most in an ideal world, I'll finish my work day a little early on Friday. And I'm cleaning the house, getting things ready. There's a lot of, ironically, a lot of work that goes into Sabbathing well. You have to prepare for it. It doesn't just, you don't accidentally Sabbath. And so I'll clean the house a little bit. I'll go shopping for whatever groceries we need. And then I start cooking a nice meal. Usually again, from scratch is in an ideal world. We'll do that. It gives me life. It doesn't drain me. And so it's something I enjoy doing. And then as Lindsay's night, her work day ends, we'll sit down right around the time that we're finishing that meal. We'll usually crack a bottle of wine open and we'll have a glass of wine and we'll light a couple candles. And we'll get into some of this, but the candles, you know, in both Exodus and Deuteronomy, Sabbath is commanded. And the first word in each of those, the first one in Exodus is to remember the Sabbath. In Deuteronomy, it's to observe the Sabbath. And so Jewish custom has been you'd put two candles on your table to remind you to remember and observe the Sabbath. And so we light those. And then I ask the girls, why do we light the candles? And they usually now roll their eyes and go, to remember and observe. But they say it, they remember it. And so we'll do that. And then we enjoy a nice meal. And that begins, that's kind of our opening ritual, if you will, for the Sabbath, is really around that. And then, our closing ritual, we actually don't have as much of one there other than...
Like a gong.
Dong. But we'll...
Sabbath gong. Yeah.
You know, oh, and I forgot to mention the Sabbath box too. That's a newer one for us, but we'll bring that out after dinner. It's a basket for us, and we'll throw most of our devices in there. So phones, watches, iPads, computers... we'll all throw that stuff in there, and they'll more or less live in there for the next 24 hours on a good day. Again, we're not great at the way our devices work in our Sabbath, but that's become a really good opening ritual too, where it's a visualization of putting work away, putting those distractions away for it to be something different.
So how do your kids react to this? Do they love it? Do they,
yeah.
Is it just kind of something that they do? I remember my family used to try to do family night. There was like a, they would always go through fads of things they wanted to do, but one of the fads was we wanted to have family night.
Yeah.
And it didn't stick around, but I hated family night. There was one family night I remember that went really well. We played Scattergories, and when my dad won, he sang a song that says, God is smiling on me. And that was a really fun night. The rest of them were pure torture.
We're just awful.
Oh, no.
So I'm curious, what are they?
No, that's such a good question, because I was talking to someone in the courtyard afterwards that was like, man, we tried the digital Sabbath thing and it blew up in our face. And just know I have had many a Sabbath blow up in my face for my own like bullheadedness, trying to force this onto people who don't want to do it, which is never the intention of Sabbath. And so that's one of the things we've learned is Lindsay and I were more committed than the girls were. And I think that's okay. You know, at first they were really resistant and we probably forced it too much on them. But we have to remember, like, if it takes us a long time to learn this, we can't expect them just to flip a switch and all of a sudden they're cool with it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something you have to think through as a family. Like, how do you ease your family into it? And I would say now, I think, and we'll have to, I've actually thought we should have my girls on the podcast to talk through their experience of Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. Actually,
they'd love that. But I asked them the other day, I was like, hey, just random, like, what's your favorite day of the week? And they both said Sabbath. They're like, oh, we love Sabbath. That's our best day of the week.
Wow.
So I think they love it. Now, again, it's a different experience than for us. I mean, it's still bar none. It is, you know, easily my favorite day of the week every week. It would have to be a really incredible week to trump Sabbath, because it's just something we'd always look forward to. But I would say that was not always the case for them. We had to get them there. And their Sabbath looks different. You know, we do allow them to watch a movie or something. It's one of the ways me and Lindsay actually get time by ourselves often, is we let them watch a show or watch a movie or play games on their iPad. Again, it's about flexibility, not rigidity. But we do try to still make it different for them. So maybe it's less movie time, maybe it's less game time on screens, but somehow we want to make it distinct from the other days. But that'd be a bit of my encouragement, is not to force a structure on to your kids, but rather what we're gonna do at our practice labs too, is invite your kids into it. And so, like, they've loved the Sabbath box. They love, for the most part, lighting the candles. We usually always try to have one family activity. Right now, often after we eat breakfast, we play Mario Kart. That's their big one, and I smoke them all the time.
Kevin's really disproportionately good at Mario Kart. It doesn't make any
sense. Brandon knows that from experience, by the way. It's not just a truth claim.
I consider myself really good at Mario Kart, and I play Kevin, and it's so frustrating. Most of the stuff Kevin and I do, we're close.
But I got you at Mario Kart.
Mario Kart is
you
not
got me at golf.
It's not
your
even
defense.
Close.
I haven't beat you at golf yet. I'm getting there. In due time.
Yeah.
But I do
my game is sharp right now, Kevin. It is sharp.
Next podcast, live on location from 12. All right. But anyway, so my encouragement to parents is go easy on your kids. It is a hard shift. But I do think my girls, I think they do love it. We'll have them on sometime and they'll share about it.
So you guys have been doing a lot of work around what you just mentioned, these practice labs.
Yeah.
And I was just talking to a friend a little bit, and he was like, what are you going to do? How are you going to practice Sabbath together in the lab? Like, and I was trying to like sell them on coming, because we're gonna do this starting on April 2nd. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
On April 2nd. We're going to practice it together after church. No, later on in the evening.
In the evening.
So you can register for the thing. We're going to feed you dinner, and we're going to somehow practice. So without necessarily giving away everything that we're going to do, this is something that you not only want adults to go to, but you want families to go to, right? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Your whole living unit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whether you have a family, if you want to bring roommates, you want to bring your community group. But I think what's cool about having the family there is that there's something for everyone to participate in, starting with that meal. Because that is one of the ways, I think, to communally practice Sabbath together. So much of the practice labs, it's going to be around tables, discussing, sharing food, sharing a meal, sharing experiences with Sabbath, both the joys and the challenges, and then hearing from other people who are processing, I think, journeying together and figuring out what does it look like for me to stop, to rest, to delight, to worship, to do that with kids, to do that as a single person, to do that as an empty nester in different stages of life.
Yeah, the food isn't just a lure to get you to show up. It's actually not. The very core of how we're going to practice Sabbath together is, again, like so much of, as Rachel was saying, that Sabbath community around a table is so key. And so that's our hope, is that the Sabbath meal at Practice Labs is what we're going to demonstrate and kind of live out four times in a row for you to enjoy. And I think I'm so excited to have kids around the table too, because I'll be honest, kids get this, although it may be harder for a shift, kids get this way better than we do. You know what I mean? We get so caught up in it.
They haven't been programmed for efficiency yet.
Exactly. And when you're talking about something like delight, I mean, kids get delight. Like they light up when they think of those things. We've been conditioned.
Like, why would life be anything but delight?
Exactly. Exactly. So I think we're going to learn a ton from our kids around Sabbath too, which is, I think it'll be fun.
Speaking of delight, we were sitting in our hot tub last Saturday at like 9:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And Charlie's in there hanging out, and she's like, "You know what I really want right now? An ice cream sandwich." 9:30 in the morning. And I was about to say no. I was like, you know, my worst form. Katie was like, "Oh, sure, fine, whatever." Yeah. So Charlie's sitting in the hot tub at 9:30 in the morning eating an ice cream sandwich. Oh, if that's not delight,
dessert. Shabbat shalom to Charlie, man. I love it. Oh, wow. That's so good. That's the dream.
So check in with us. Do this. Join us. We're all trying it out together. Stay along for the journey. And let's see what this does to our lives.
Let's see where it goes. I'm excited. Try it out. And share your stories with us.
I'm going to let Rachel end with a Tim Gombas quote. Go ahead, Rachel.
All right. Life is like an ice cream sandwich in a hot tub.
Yes.
I don't know. I was trying to think of a smart word.
It's sweet. It's hot.